This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. Today we'll start our show talking with Scott Davis. He's the Executive Director of the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission, and it's about a brand new resource that's been opened in the state for law enforcement training. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Doug, for having me. Thank you.
The U.S. Indian Law Enforcement Advanced Training Center opened last week at Camp Grafton in North Dakota. What is the significance of this event?
Well, it was a pretty big event, a very important event, an event that was a long time in the making. I look back probably, at least a good 10 years when there was a certain amount of tribal leaders back then talking about creating a northern training center for the Bureau of Indian Affairs law enforcement officers to be trained and eventually become, police officers for Indian country, and particular Great Plains in North Dakota. So that was talked about. I was part of those discussions, more or less listening in my role back in those days. And then my former boss, Senator Hovind now, stepped up here in the last couple of years through a field hearing he held on law enforcement and crime in Indian country at the United Tribes Technical College. And from there, it spurred up again. Tribal leaders stepped up and stepped forward and said, hey, you know, where there's a lack of law enforcement officers in North Dakota, in the Great Plains, and we really need to do something different in getting officers to Indian country. So we all know that throughout Indian country in North Dakota, that there was only one place to get training, an academy for officers in America, and that's down in Artesia, New Mexico. And that's always been, a barrier for a lot of folks getting down there, spending, X amount of months, to get trained and then certified. So to have one up here through the partnership with Senator Hovind's office, his leadership, the tribes of North Dakota, obviously the governor's office played a major role in that, and also the National Guard looking at where could we place a campus or create a new campus for a BA law enforcement. So we looked at Camp Grafton and wow, what an amazing place, you know. So that really fit the bill. And so it went through its process with funding and appropriations and, you know, probably more or less federal processes of how to get, the academy up there in partnership with the National Guard Camp Grafton. So, And it came to fruition. A lot of people behind the scenes that were there, a lot of people, I could probably name them later, but, it was well needed, a huge unmet need. And hopefully we'll be starting classes, I think, this November, in fact. So more to come on that, definitely.
Well, you mentioned Senator John Hovind. He's the chair of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs and a member of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and he helped secure a $2.5 million funding for this program in the current fiscal year. Does that mean it'll be repeated every year? It's an ongoing need, I take it. So this is the initial year and it goes on from here?
Yes, correct. You know, that, like with most things in Congress, whether you're in the country or not, a lot of things are appropriated by Congress, whether it's year to year or, 5 years, just depending. But so my hope, I'm very confident that Senator Hovind, Senator Kramer, and Congressman Armstrong will continue to support this center, this training academy up in Camp Grafton, and, for the long term. So I have no doubt that that'll continue. But it's always like everything, it needs funds to operate in O&M and make sure that things are paid for and sustained. And the other thing about this too, I think there's definitely a lot more than just the BIA federal component on this too. You know, I think the long term that we've talked internally was how can we share this academy with everybody? You know, you have local sheriffs, you have local city law enforcement, sheriffs, chief of police, you have border patrol, you have FBI, you have, U.S. Marshals, you have a wide array of law enforcement entities in North Dakota and throughout the Great Plains. And how can we all share this resource? So that's one thing that we're seriously going to be looking at, is those partnerships, which will include funding and like for example, a track, a driving course. I mean, that's a big part of law enforcement training for the feds. And right now, there's not one there located in Camp Grafton. So those are looking at ideas that we need to work on together. Like Highway Patrol needs to utilize a track, a driving course for some of their training and there are certain some of their certifications. So those are things that I think we need to continue to partner on, look at, and funding and cost share for the benefit for all law enforcement throughout North Dakota, Great Plains, and our region.
Scott Davis is Executive Director of the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission. We're talking about the brand new U.S. Indian Law Enforcement Advanced Training Center that is opening at Camp Grafton, which has been a longtime National Guard training center. When it begins accepting students, you said it will probably get going in November. What's its capacity? How many people need to be given this kind of training?
That's a good question. You know, my good buddy, Steve Juno, he's the academy director. He runs the academy down in Artesia, New Mexico. And I know he had mentioned kind of the first class starting November. And I know I'm not sure what the capacity is, but when I was down there in Artesia visiting the campus and looking at the classrooms, the courses and so forth, it seems to me there was anywhere from like, you know, 10 to almost 30 cadets at a time per year or per year and a half, seems like, depending on the length of that academy. So up here, I know it's getting its kind of the starting point of classwork. I'm not certain exactly what classroom or I guess coursework would be started here in November, but that definitely a Steve Juno question. And but either way, it's starting, and that's you know, great things always start small. And so I look forward to a great beginning for the Law Enforcement Center up at Camp Grafton.
You've mentioned the training center in Artesia, New Mexico. I think there's one also operated by the Navajo Nation. Is the operative word here in the one at Camp Grafton advanced training center? Is this a something that goes beyond what they do in Artesia?
Yeah, I think so, because I know Steve had mentioned that there's going to be more in-depth courses like missing, murdered Indigenous women, people. You know, that's a big issue right now facing Indian country. We've been through a number of those cases here in North Dakota. Unfortunately, you know, Savannah's Act was just passed here with the help of our congressionals and former Senator Heitkamp, and now eventually signed by President Trump here just the other day. So that's a one big issue of provide coursework and training when it comes to missing and murdered Indigenous women and people. The other one is the forensics. I think the other one, looking at forensics, you know, is very, very needed with DNA and all those things. And also that ties in with the cold cases. We all know that in a country with limited resources, limited officers, and limited expertise in certain areas, cold cases is a big issue, you know. So those are the three issues, that three courseworks that Mr. Juna had really touched upon, that I think is going to be much different than the training center down in Artesia. So great timing for that, and very needed for those type of coursework and training for any country.
You mentioned a number of issues that have been in the news and that have sometimes pointed at basically a shortage of law enforcement personnel in areas that need more attention. How severe is the shortage of law enforcement personnel in Indian country, and specifically North Dakota?
Yeah, it's always been a shortage. You know, you know, it's something that I grew up with, Doug, even my time working for my tribe down in Stanhope for almost 8 years. You know, have been friends in law enforcement, really good friends who've been there. I got a couple of friends who are retiring now, and kind of tells you how old I'm getting, but you know, looking across the board in the country, it's always been about half, you know, fully half capacity. And I think in the Great Plains, Senator Hovind alluded to about 60% up here in the Great Plains of shortage. So, you know, and it's tough, you know, when you have one or two officers that cover large land bases, in particular the Great Plains, it really makes it hard on our officers to cover large land bases when you're getting those 911 calls and so forth. And then the detail process, that's always been a barrier too. And you have an officer that has been working, say on Spirit Lake for, a year or two, and then all of a sudden gets a call from his superiors in Aberdeen or Washington, D.C., and said, "Hey, we got to detail you down to Navajo or out to, Montana or somewhere because they're short of officers too." So you kind of have this, the shell game of officers moving from time to time throughout in the country. So it's been hard. It's been hard to have that consistent, long-term officers on reservations, and that's just the nature of the BIA, and I'm never gonna point the finger at them or blame on anything because I know them very well. I have great working relationships. They work very well with our offices and our state offices, and but that's just kind of the nature of the feds, in the country. So hopefully this academy will remedy that and providing more well-funded long-term officers for in the country. That'll stay, on each tribe, and be more consistent in curbing that crime. So, but that's just kind of how it is. Like growing up, that like I said, my years, 25 years plus, working for an in country now, it's been that way. It's been the norm. So, I think this is a duly time for to make it better, change it, and make it more sustainable for in country.
Well, it seems that there's been for a long time now an emphasis nationwide on what we would call community-based policing. So it seems odd that the BIA would be sending officers from one reservation to another. What is the essential problem with finding enough officers? Is it the funding? Is it paying them? Is it not a good enough wage? Is it a cultural issue? What are the complications here?
From what I what I'm told in the conversation I've been, I think it's some of the things that you just mentioned there. One is the obviously the Artesia base in New Mexico. Having a base more up in the northern part of the United States, more I guess what we call Indian country up here, is more that home away from home. Spirit Lake's right there. You have probably anywhere within 4 hours, you have almost 40 tribes that are located close to the Devil's Lake area. So that's at home away from home. So it is a little bit of cultural, I'll say, for cadets to go somewhere and to have that training and feel comfortable in that environment, and then obviously go on and beyond and graduate and become a great officer. But and I think that the other thing is the funding and the recruiting. I think anything that comes from the feds, as we all see, whether it's, I don't care what federal agency, FBI, U.S. Marshals, ATF, I think you just don't see a lot of campaigning or recruitment materials out there because of federal funds. So those are things I know that the BIA has seriously looked into as far as recruiting and long-term funding. But those are things that our congressional teams in North Dakota have really looked into and supported, and so I'm thankful for that. And obviously, our governor very supportive of whatever he can do to support that. And even our local legislators, in the state, we've talked about it as well. A lot of support here locally with our state legislators trying to figure out innovative ways to help tribes with crime and public safety. So it's been a a very very strong effort for all of us to improve public safety in the country. So, but yeah, it is some of those issues that you alluded to, and I see that. But again, I think with the new campus up here in the Great Plains, it's going to have I think more of our younger folks wanted to look at a campus here up here in North Dakota and attend and graduate and again, become a good officer for any country.
Scott, you mentioned that there is the possibility of expanding sort of the service mission of the brand new U.S. Indian Law Enforcement Advanced Training Center at Camp Grafton in North Dakota to help, other law enforcement agencies that aren't reservation-based to get training. Is there law enforcement collaboration between tribal and county governments that needs to be improved, or how would you characterize the relationships between Indian country and outside the reservation?
That's a very good question. I'm glad you brought up, Doug. Something that we've been working on since, you know, I started this thing 11 years ago. You know, I've always had this theory that, you know, we as tribal citizens are also state citizens as well. And as a county resident, as an example, we should be afforded the same services as everybody. And sometimes tribes look at that as more of a sovereignty thing, like, okay, well, we're sovereign. And I totally understand that. I believe in that wholeheartedly. But as a sovereign nation, sometimes our tribes are reluctant in looking at outside resources or assets, such as law enforcement, to come in and help patrol or keep public safety on reservations, because they're very used to, accustomed to those treaty obligations from the U.S. government, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, to provide those law enforcement services. But my theory has always been, well, you know, that it's just not working. It's never funded enough. It's always half of what we should be getting. It's half of, we're always half staffed on law enforcement. So how can we partner and exercise this sovereignty, you know, with counties, with higher patrol, with border patrol, you know, and providing protection services and so forth. So one example that has been working for a number of years is McLean County. You know, Sheriff Kurzman and his department have done a tremendous job in working with partnership with the MHA Nation on exercising an MOA, Memorandum of Agreement, Memorandum of Understanding. So example is 911, right? Here's the strong example that we've went through when it comes to legal jurisdiction. So you have a tribal member, someone calls 911 from a tribal home. The dispatcher says, you know, are you a tribal member or not? And the caller says, well, what does that matter? Well, legally, you know, that dispatcher didn't have the legal right to send a county deputy to a tribal home because they didn't have the jurisdiction on tribal lands. So at first it felt discriminative, like, why isn't the county responding to 911 to these calls? Well, you know, it's a legal issue. So how do we get around that? So with McLean County and MHA Nation, we remedied that through an agreement. So under tribal law, anytime a tribal member in McLean County calls 911, whoever the closest officer is, whether it's county or tribal, they respond to that house. And under three conditions, they have that tribal law to detain the situation, use of force, and also high-speed chases if needed. So those are things that have been working very well up in the MHA Nation in McLean County. And that has been growing. So our hope is to keep that going with other counties, with Rolette County, Benson, Ramsey, Sioux County, and so forth. But obviously it goes down to tribal leaders' decision if they want to exercise those resources. Same with higher patrol. You know, we've reached out numerous times with tribes. Hey, you know, if you need mutual aid assistance, we're here. You know, higher patrol is here to help you. And however you as tribal leaders need us to be. So if you need us to, for high speed chase, for, you know, for traffic control, or you know, traffic saturations, whatever, you know, highway patrols want to do that. So we've been very, very supportive of tribal leadership. Highway patrol, Colonel Solberg and his team have been very strong in reaching out to tribes, saying, hey, we're here to help if you need be. You know, search and rescue, using our planes. You know, the example with Olivia Lone Bear years ago and searching for her. I mean, there was a lot of assets that the tribe had used, and you know, myself, our office really molded that relationship, calling for all assets throughout North Dakota to help the MHA Nation in searching for Miss Olivia Lone Bear. And so you had deputy sheriffs, highway patrol, border patrol, the feds, all searching for her, and you know, unfortunately it didn't turn out very well, but it proved my point that we can do this by working together in searching for a missing person. And again, no matter if she's native or not, you know, we have elderly that come up and seeing silver alerts, amber alerts that require broad law enforcement assistance. But legally, you know, these are things that go back to legal issues with tribe sovereignty. And by no means do we want to ever impede on tribal sovereignty, but these are the things that we want to lay out legally through a MOA, MOU agreement, and making sure that our state and perhaps even federal law enforcement agencies are doing the right thing in protecting and exercising tribal sovereignty as the tribes see fit. So that's a good thing. That's a good thing. And I think that's the other piece of this training center that will be offered, is training in how do you work with, the counties, the border towns, the chief of police's. Do you have the same training background? Because these academies, they're highly trained. I'm pretty impressed by the real in-depth training that they go through. So again, these are just the examples that are working here in North Dakota, and that we want to expound upon in the near future.
Scott, just got a couple of minutes left, but this conversation prompts me to ask, talk about the cooperation among tribes in general across the country for common issues like law enforcement, economic development, healthcare, education. Do tribal nations need to consolidate their political power?
That's a good question. And I think the ones that I see that exercise sovereignty, that reach out and partner with other government agencies, whether they're government, private, nonprofit, whatever, I think you see a huge, I guess, more opportunities that come to tribal nations, and they're out there. I mean, but again, you come through some of the legal hurdles of sovereign immunity, and so forth. So economic development is another thing I've been working heavily on throughout my career. But I think the ones that the tribes that have championed those partnerships with outside entities have really flourished, so again, it's a tough call when tribal leaders are really pushing hard with Congress and the treaties, the trust responsibility for government to adhere to those treaties when it comes to economic development, health and safety, education, and so forth. And it's just been tough. I strongly believe that those treaty obligations will probably never be fulfilled. So that's my personal opinion. So how does we look at ways differently to help and partner with tribal nations when it comes to those issues of development and jobs and long-term quality of life for nations here in North Dakota?
Well, in an ideal world or country or state, what changes or improvements would you like to see put in place for Indian nations?
Well, they're happening. I think, since Governor Burgum took office, his initiative on tribal engagement has been huge, and these things take time. There's been a number of MOUs and accords that we've signed in his 4 years here, and we hope if once hopefully he get reelected, that we'll continue those partnerships and more of these accords, these MOUs, agreements, I call them mini treaties, if you will, that will get signed more on economic development, healthcare, probably in the midst of COVID, our tribal state relations can be more stronger than ever. We've really partnered strongly on COVID, on testing, the vaccine. We've talked heavily on that planning. I think tribes are leaning to joining us on if and when the vaccine comes available, they'll be joining us on that. So, and it's trust. I think Governor Burgum, my office, we worked very, very hard improving that we want to make long-term investments and partnerships with the tribes, and that we care. And I really believe our tribal leaders see that, they believe it, they trust it, and they want to move forward, providing every opportunity to our tribal people on reservations here in North Dakota.
Scott Davis is Executive Director of the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission. We've been talking about the U.S. Indian Law Enforcement Advanced Training Center, which was dedicated a week ago today. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Doug, for having me.
Coming up on Main Street, our weekly news chat with our news director, Dave Thompson, and Matt Olean goes to the movies. He wasn't terribly impressed. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
As we celebrate the 75th UN World Food Day, I'm very proud to be able to give today a $1 million check here, Great Plains Food Bank.
Brian Nermo is president and CEO of Sanford Health Fargo and says the $1 million donation is part of a larger effort to support food banks around the region. The $3 million campaign will help provide meals to families in Minnesota, Iowa, and North and South Dakota.
There is really no way that we can do what we do without having a strong community. And a strong community means that everyone in our community is feeling that they have the opportunity to go out every day and have a strong family. And that's just incredibly hard to do if you're focusing on that your family is hungry and your family doesn't have the nutrition that it needs to go to school, to go to work, to live every single day.
Food Bank spokeswoman Taylor Sievertson says the gift is part of what she says has been profound generosity seed by the food bank since the pandemic started. She says gifts to the food bank have been a saving grace in a time of increased need. Sievertson says the $1 million gift from Sanford will help provide more than 2.5 million meals across North Dakota. September airline boardings in North Dakota were just under 40,000 for the month. That's 44% of the passenger numbers from last year. State Aeronautics Commission Executive Director Kyle Warner says it isn't where the state wants to be, but
it's the best month retention rate-wise since the beginning of the pandemic, so it's still a positive trend moving forward.
Warner says it's still something to watch going forward.
We hope that we still continue to see a positive trend in that retention rate so that, you know, the airlines can continue to be viable, you know, in our state and other places around the country as well. So it's just a difficult time, and we just hope that people can continue to look to air travel as one of their options if they do plan to travel.
Warner says Delta Airlines has suspended service to Williston, and he hopes that will soon be reinstated. And a significant clipper system will bring snow to parts of North Dakota later tonight into tomorrow. Rick Kroliak is with the National Weather Service in Bismarck. He says some parts of the state could see accumulating snow.
Most of the highest amounts are concentrated up toward the northern part of the state, extending southeast, pretty much east, just east of Divide County, southern Burke County, southeast over toward the Carrington area. We could see some areas that have closer to 6 inches, an isolated 6 inch, but generally up that way looking for 3 to 5.
Kroliak says the further south you go in the state, the lesser the amounts will be. He says along and south of I-94, the amounts will be a trace to 2 inches and maybe 2 to 3 inches in the Grand Forks area. He says things should clear out by tomorrow night. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You know, it's a very unique environment because it's been a part of Mexico, it's been part of Texas, the country, part of Texas, the state. It's part of the Deep South, it's part of the Southwest, it's kind of a little bit of everything.
That's how we feel about this show. Join us this week on Away With Words.
After hearing your explanation of it, it makes a lot of sense.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Every Friday on our show, we hear that old news wire machine in the background.
Model 15, if you remember that.
Okay.
Yes.
And Dave Thompson, our news director, joins me on our Fridays to talk about the week in review. And Dave, actually, the reason you and I are facing each other in Fargo, because you're usually in the studio in Bismarck, is because you're here for another debate, right?
Right. I'm going to be the moderator for tonight's DPI debate, Brant Dick versus Kirsten Baszler.
And that's an interesting debate because usually Department of Public Instruction doesn't get a whole lot of attention.
But it does this time. There's a lot of spotlight on this race, and there are a lot of pundits, and I'm going to say pundits because that's who I'm hearing from, think it could be a close race.
Well, it's two Republicans who are vying for the same spot, and they have some differences.
They do have some differences, and of course you've got somebody who's working as a school superintendent, somebody who's working as the state superintendent. Interesting, and of course, it's the only non-judicial, non-partisan race on the ballot that's left. You know, that's a no-party office.
Yeah, it is, but everybody's always vying for an endorsement.
Yeah, they get, quote, letters of support, end quote.
Okay. Well, let's go to the really big story of the week, and that is these numbers in North Dakota just keep going up. This is
right.
We're closing in on 900 positive tests now.
I know. Now it's very close. It's 877 right now.
Yeah.
And another number of deaths have happened. And again, I hear this from some people who have wondered about the fact that we report that they had underlying health conditions. Well, the reason why we do that, and I've come up with some, I think, some very good reasons to do this, but I think the major reason is we want to be transparent, that there have been a few deaths that are simply because of COVID, but most of them COVID exacerbates underlying health conditions like diabetes, high blood pressure, things like that. And that's why we report it the way we do.
Yep, the bottom line is they wouldn't have died if they didn't have COVID.
Probably. That's probably true.
And we had 18 new deaths with this 877 positive cases reported today. So this is not under control.
No, and we're coming up on 400 deaths then, very close to it.
Meanwhile, the governor's been on defense recently over his handling of the pandemic in North Dakota. You know, whether or not there should be a mask mandate, whether or not there should be other ways to, you know, keep people from transmitting the virus.
Right. And the argument for a mask mandate is, yes, you're not going to have, you know, mask mandate cops everywhere, but it might get people to say, we really need to do this. But there are others, including the governor, who say it should be a matter of personal responsibility. And I think in a real world situation, I'm not sure where I come down on that. But, you know, if people did show some personal responsibility, we would have masks. I will tell you, in looking at the eastern part of the state, there's more mask wearing than there is in the west.
Yeah, I see it everywhere now. Yes. And I'm encouraged by that because we are a high-risk area now in Cass County, as you are in Burley County.
Cass, Burley, there are 16 counties that are high-risk now. And we see these cases going up, and they're trying to, as they say, bend the curve. Now you've got a percentage rate based on testing of 10%. They want to get that down to 5%. That may not seem like, you know, that much of a goal, but that's cutting it in half.
And if you look at those tests of unique tests, those people who have not been tested over and over and over again, that percentage is sky high.
Right. That is a real concern. I know that there are health officials who are worried about that. I know there are people in the Bergman administration who are worried about that too. But they're trying to avoid mandates at this point.
Well, everybody seems to be politically sensitive about mandates, and everybody's got an opinion about them, but this is a virus and it doesn't have any thought process. It just moves from person to person. So that it does seem that social distancing, wearing a mask, doing the things
frequent
you can.
Frequent hand washing, don't touch your face, things like that.
Protect other people. Yep. I mean, it's not all about us or me or you.
Exactly, that's right.
So this continues, and the governor is walking kind of a difficult political position here, but he's also facing what will likely be a re-election.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the governor is looking strong in terms of the November ballot. And despite the fact that he has a Democratic opponent, Shelley Lenz, who is making COVID-19 a big issue.
Right. And speaking of that, we'll have a debate with the governor candidates, including the Libertarian, next week, Wednesday night.
All right. Well, let's talk about another aspect about the election that is an unusual wrinkle, and that is the deceased legislative candidate who might win.
That is, this is unusual because the ballots were printed and David Ondal from District 8 contracted COVID and passed away, basically. And he had some underlying conditions again. But what do you do? The ballots are already printed. Many people have voted absentee, so what do you do? In interpreting the Constitution, the Attorney General has said he's on the ballot. If he wins, then they will declare a vacancy in that seat. And that means that the Republican district committee, the executive committee, is going to come up with a replacement. This is an interesting scenario because, remember, Jeff Delzer, longtime House Appropriations Chair from Underwood, did not receive the endorsement. He ran in the primary, did not win in the primary. The two Davids won in the primary. But there is potential that he could be reappointed.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do, this could get very interesting in terms of some of the political things that are at play. Because if you remember, Governor Burgum's PAC campaigned against him.
And he's invested a lot of money in that PAC.
He invested a lot of money in the PAC. And if he is appointed and he gets back as chairman of House Appropriations, this session could get a whole lot more focused. Let's put it that way.
Well, I was also intrigued by this idea that on the ballot, if somebody who is deceased, whose name is on the ballot, then as the Attorney General says, the local Republican county group can name that successful candidate. And it's almost like, well, why don't you just put Republican on the ballot? Why put a name on it?
Well, that's an interesting point, but that is the way it since I think we decided it was in 2007 that the law changed that if somebody resigns or dies while in office, then the party committee gets to appoint somebody. Before that, there would have to be a special election.
Yeah.
And there is a provision that voters in the district, and I cannot remember the percentage, can actually call for a special election probably after the legislative session.
Oh, it's a Gordian knot.
It is.
Okay. You know, we have talked about this issue that we're about to bring up here several times, and I've done long interviews with it. This is your story from earlier this week. Blue Flint Ethanol starts a CO2 storage research project.
Right.
And is this too little too late?
Now, that's an interesting question because, you know, you have Blue Flint Ethanol that's part of Coal Creek. You know, they're co-located, different owners, but co-located because Blue Flint uses the steam from the plant to produce ethanol. Well, at the same time this is happening, they're looking for ways to replace that steam in case Coal Creek Station shuts down, which it is scheduled to shut down in 2022. But at this point, if this turns out to be successful to store carbon underground at that site, they say this might help find a buyer for the Coal Creek Station plant. So well, everything's kind of interrelated there.
I find this intriguing in terms of a public policy debate because we
right.
talk about subsidies for various forms of energy. Well, they're going to be paid to sequester CO2.
Right.
So that's basically a subsidy to do what needs to be done.
Yes, it is. And they're talk about the wind energy tax credit, which they want to go away. And there are other subsidies for other energy sources, so to speak. So it's interesting in that the legislature, I should say Congress, is the actual one who did the thing about some kind of tax break for this sequestration.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the Project Tundra, which is going on at the Milton Young plant.
Yes, there's great interest at the Energy and Environmental Resource Center at UND has been involved in this research for a
yes.
long time. But again, Coal Creek's going to be closed down in a year or so?
That's what they think. However, there's now apparently some interest by some other energy companies in maybe keeping that plant running. Should be interesting to watch this one.
Yeah, it's quite a facility.
It is a big facility.
It would be a heck of an empty building.
Yes, it would be.
Okay. Well, let's talk about another issue that has been exacerbated by the pandemic, and that's the airline travel industry. And North Dakota, of course, is one of those places where occasionally we lose airlines because they don't have enough traffic.
Correct.
And the pandemic blew a hole in traffic.
It certainly did. If you think about, you know, early spring when it was down to 5% capacity, now they're up to 44% capacity, not exactly where they want to be, but it's the trends are looking better. Still, Delta pulled out of Williston.
Mm.
And United has added service to Williston recently. United flies to Denver.
Well,
so that's that energy connection.
Well, that's good because Williston's got that brand new airport.
That huge new airport, yes.
You reported on Tuesday of this week that North Dakota State University has dedicated a garden on Indigenous Peoples Day. A lot has been going on about the awareness
right.
of Native Americans to the settlement of this place and the land we're on.
Exactly. And President Bershani said that one reason that he was all for this project is he wants this garden to be more than just a garden, but a point where people can start discussing things like racism and, you know, how we treat Indigenous people. He wants that to be a conversation starting point. And I think that's fascinating to me.
Well, you know, my conversation with Scott Davis that we started the show with today, we had a number of discussions about the relationship between Native American tribes in the state and other entities of government and how occasionally they've been strained and how this new training center at Camp Grafton
right,
might offer
right.
some opportunities for non-natives to take this kind of training too.
Absolutely. And we see that all over the state that, you know, Fargo's not the only place that calls it Indigenous Peoples Day. Grand Forks does, Minot does. And there are other cities that are doing it too.
Well, we used to call it Columbus Day for many, many years. And now Columbus's actual incursion in the New World has been looked at with a little more flinty-eyed realism, I think.
Exactly.
And, of course, it's Indigenous Peoples Day around the world and Native American Day in the United States. So we're remembering some very important pieces of history here.
We certainly are, yes.
Well, let's talk about what we woke up to this morning, Dave. It's October. I know we had that hellacious storm a year ago.
A year ago, that's correct, where some places got 8 to 12 inches of snow. Now, this weekend, there might be a narrow band that might get 6 inches of snow. But in and along I-94, it looks like 0 to 2. At least that's the forecast right now. Stay tuned. It may change in 6 to 12 hours.
I might be dodging south of 94 just for a drive to remember what fall was like.
Exactly.
Okay. We check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. Always a pleasure, Dave.
Thank you, Doug.
Author Larry Watson may live in Wisconsin, but
I'll always be a North Dakotan. There's no place I know or will ever know the way I know Bismarck, my hometown.
And this Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, he'll be talking about his book, The Lives of Edie Pritchard, here on Prairie Public. He's got a sense of the landscape.
Curving its way into the first of a series of low hills, each stitched to the next with a narrow, dark strip of cottonwood or bur oak.
A sense of the people.
When I was a little girl, Edie says, my dad took us up to Canada, just drove across the border and turned around and came back again, so we could say we'd been there.
Sense of how things happen around here.
Each section would involve a road trip. After all, so many important moments for Americans occur inside our automobiles.
Hear him talk about how he made the book and what people get from it this Sunday at 5 Central.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olien. And this week, Matt, you found a movie in a theater, but it doesn't sound like you were overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, unfortunately, I found a movie in the theater, unfortunately, because The War with Grandpa is the single worst movie I've seen in the theater this year. Now, of course, there was 5 months where I was not seeing movies in theaters, but I think even if I was, Doug, this would be probably at the top of the list. This was shot a couple years ago. It's another Robert De Niro comedy. I'll get to that in a minute, my thoughts on this. And he moves in with his daughter, and she has kids, his grandkids, and they give him the son's room, and the son has to move to the attic, and the son doesn't like that, so they start this war, and it's just crazy nonsense stupidity. But the real problem with this film, Doug, is it's so poorly acted. The kids aren't any good that they found to play the roles. Uma Thurman, who plays Robert De Niro's daughter, it took me 15 minutes to realize that was Uma Thurman. I thought this was some bad actress they found off the street to play the mom role, but she's terrible in the movie. And we kind of get this Christopher Walken, Robert De Niro reunion from The Deer Hunter. Remember, that's the film they made, a pretty good movie.
Yeah.
Not this one. This is not the reunion we were waiting for these two guys to do zany madcap comedy together. It is poorly written, poorly scripted, poorly directed. The acting is mediocre. The pacing is not the right pacing for a comedy. And you just wonder why they released this now. And let's talk about De Niro for a second. Can you think of a more strange career arc, Doug, for an actor than Robert De Niro? He goes from Godfather to Deer Hunter, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, these serious award-winning roles, and now he, for 15 years, he's basically done these ridiculous physical comedy things, and it's not in his wheelhouse. He's not terribly funny. They're bad movies, but I have heard, and I think you have too, Doug, he needs the money. He's made some poor investments, I think, in New York City that have not paid off, and he's probably just doing this stuff for the money now.
Well, the script sounds like it was not a great idea to start with. I mean, talk about a thin premise. Upset that he has to share the room he loves with his grandfather, Peter decides to declare war and attempt to get it back. That's a movie?
And also, Doug, So De Niro's character loses his wife, so he's a widow, which is why Uma Thurman wants him to move in. So he just lost his wife, which is this boy's grandmother, and the boy acts like the most ungrateful. You talk about a first world problem. He goes to war with his grandpa because he has to go up to the attic, and his grandpa just lost his wife. I mean, he's the most spoiled kid you might see on a screen this year, so you have no sympathy for this kid whatsoever. The pratfalls are stupid. Two times we get De Niro flashing people by accident. That's supposed to be funny. There's a dodgeball sequence between the old people, Chris Walken and Jane Seymour is in the movie, and they have a dodgeball fight with the kids. That's ineptly handled as well. It's just a bad movie, but it won the box office last weekend. It beat Tenet, and I think it made $3.5 million, so maybe it was a good idea for them to release it.
Well, that does sound like part of the strategy, because I noted when I went to IMDb, the internet database about movies, that there were several release dates that failed, like back in April of 2017, October of 2017, February of 2018. So it's like maybe the people they were releasing it to were not too excited about it.
Yeah, I think I said they shot it 2 years ago. I think might be more accurate, Doug. This was shot like 3.5 or 4 years ago. So this has been sitting on the shelf for a long time, and that's where it should have stayed.
Yeah, should have gotten real dusty.
Yeah. Okay. De Niro's not going to get a third Oscar for this one. That is my guarantee of the year. I'm calling it right now.
All right. Well, then we'll jump right to the contest here, because as our listeners know, every week I try to stump Matt with an Oscar trivia question, and you've kind of answered a piece of this, but I'm going into the weeds a little bit, and that is, what are the two movies that Robert De Niro has won an Oscar for?
The Godfather Part II and Raging Bull.
That is correct. Now, we'll step into a little more of history, because you mentioned some of these other movies, but this guy has got a canon of movies behind him. These are some wonderful films.
Let's talk
about the ones he was nominated for. First in 1977.
Yeah, Taxi Driver, and then The Deer Hunter, and then later for Awakenings, Cape Fear, and finally Silver Linings Playbook was his most recent nomination.
And that was for supporting actor, but wow, what a skill. This guy has got a real resume. It's a shame it is
ruining it
stuck
now.
With the war with Grandpa.
Yeah, there won't be any triple features, Taxi Driver, Deer Hunter, and the War with Grandpa. I don't think that'll happen.
Okay, but we might see it on some drive-in bill with the Fockers or something like that.
Yeah, Meet the Fockers, which was better than this.
Okay. We go to the movies every week with Matt O'Lee.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra is for people who treasure music and the arts. Hi, I'm Maestro Beverly Everett. We're performing our full concert schedule this season. Details are subject to change. Don't miss Fate and Fantasy, October 17th, featuring our 2019 Young Artist winners and a celebration of Beethoven's 250th birthday. For up-to-date concert and ticket information, visit BismarckMandanSymphony.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 16th. Mail delivery wasn't always universal. Before rural delivery began in 1902, people in rural areas had to pick up their mail at their local post office. This wasn't always convenient, and in bad weather, mail could be delayed for weeks. John Wanamaker was the Postmaster General from 1889 until 1893. When a farmer complained to him that city folks had fancy mail service while country folks had to pick up their mail, Wanamaker began to address that inequity. After all, country folks paid the same price for a postage stamp as city folks. Wanamaker thought that rural mail delivery would improve the lives of rural folks and expand business opportunities. He proposed free rural mail delivery, but Congress balked at the $6 million price tag. As a compromise, Wanamaker suggested a pilot program that would determine if his plan were feasible. Congress thought even a $100,000 price tag for that was too much, but in the end, $10,000 was allocated. In 1893, Wilson Bissell succeeded Wanamaker as Postmaster General. Instead of offering rural free delivery, he proposed adding more post offices. The next postmaster, William Wilson, didn't think Wanamaker's plan for rural delivery was practical, but he was willing to test it out. West Virginia was the first state to offer rural free delivery in 1896. By the following year, the post office was operating 44 routes in 29 states. The post office received thousands of petitions from rural customers asking for the service. The National Grange, the National Farmers Congress, and the State Farmers Alliance threw support behind nationwide delivery. In 1898, Wahpeton became the first North Dakota post office to offer rural delivery, and in 1902, it became available nationwide. There was a learning curve for some. On this date, in 1908, the Golden Valley Chronicle printed a letter from the postmaster in Sentinel Butte, North Dakota. The postmaster had received a complaint from a customer about delayed delivery. He explained that rural mail delivery was not always an easy matter. In fact, he had been looking for this particular customer for several weeks. The man had a homestead, but had not put up a mailbox. Gilbert wrote, "I am not hunting Mr. Drewneck with a letter in my pocket." He suggested that Drewneck put up a mailbox like everybody else. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, comedian Sarah Cooper tells us that even fans of the president like her videos in which she lip-syncs his speeches.
That's the weirdest thing about this. I've only been called the C word twice.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for a show that appeals to almost everyone. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As many of you know, as we broadcast, we stream at praypublic.org. And after the broadcast, in case you missed it, you can find any Main Street show archived as a podcast at praypublic.org. Monday on our show, we'll visit with North Dakota State University Assistant Professor of History Donald Johnson. He's the author of Occupied America, British Military Rule and the Experience of Revolution. His book looks at the lives of people under occupation as the British sought to end the revolution. And our candidate interviews will continue. We'll talk with Josh Gallion. He's running for another term as North Dakota State Auditor. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday and perhaps check out Main Street Weekend Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.